I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Apiango Line, a podcast dedicated to the unique culture and local heritage of the Upper Madawaska and Apiango River Valleys here in Eastern Ontario, Canada. Today, we're joined by Leslie Betts, Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, and Mark Wormke, all members of the Apiango Readers Theatre. They're back again with our annual St. Patrick's Day show, and this year, it's all about a genial little fellow with a dry wit and easy humor called Father O'Flynn. Now, just to set the record straight, there are three distinct Father O'Flynns. One, Father O'Flynn is the name of a much-loved 1875 Irish jig, instantly recognizable if you have ever stepped inside an Irish pub at the sound of a traditional fiddler after rosining up his bow. Two, Father O'Flynn is also the title of a 1935 movie. And three, the original Father O'Flynn was nothing more nor less than a fictional priest created by Alfred Percival Graves, an Irish poet, songwriter, and folklorist. Graves is the true comic genius who wrote the original 1875 lyric that went along with that Irish jig. But he also wrote Recollections of Father Flynn at the beginning of the 20th century. It's a collection of tales Graves often told in person and then published in popular magazines of his day. Alfred Percival Graves was the son of an Anglican bishop of Limerick, and he based his fictional Irish Roman Catholic priest on an affable country man of the cloth he once knew, a certain Father Walsh. The real priest worked along the west coast of Ireland, and it was from there that Graves picked up much of Father O'Flynn's nimble wit and genial humor from the local rustics of Munster, fellows like Jeremiah O'Shea and Milk Malarkey. But rather than describe that humor, let's just rip into the fun of those Father O'Flynn anecdotal stories. But first, here's that famous Irish jig lyric that Alfred Percival Graves wrote back in 1875 that got the whole world of Father O'Flynn kick-started. Of priests we can often a charm and variety, far renowned for learning and piety. Still I'd advance you without impropriety, Father O'Flynn, as the flower of them all. Here's a health to you, Father O'Flynn. Schlaunty and schlaunty and schlaunty again. Powerfulest preacher and tenderest creature and kindliest creature in old Donegal. Don't talk of your provost and fellows of Trinity, famous for ever at Greek and Latinity, Dad, and the divils of all at divinity, Father O'Flynn'd make hares of them all. Come, I venture to give ye my word, never the likes of his logic was heard, down from mythology into theology, troth and conchology, if he'd the call. Here's a health to you, Father O'Flynn, schlaunty and schlaunty and schlaunty again, powerfulest preacher and tenderest creature and kindliest creature in old Donegal. Ach, Father O'Flynn, you're the wonderful way with you. All old sinners are wishful to pray with you. All the young children are wild for to play with you. You've such a way with you, Father O'Vic. Still, for all you've so gentle a soul, gad you've your flock in the grandest control, checking the crazy ones, coaxing the lazy ones, lifting the lazy ones on with a stick. Here's a health to you, Father O'Flynn, schlaunty and schlaunty and schlaunty again, powerfulest preacher and tenderest creature and kindliest creature in old Donegal. And though quite in a void in all foolish frivolity, still, at all seasons of inegality, where was the playboy could claim an equality at comicality, Father, with you? Once the bishop looked grave at your jest, till this remark sent him off with a rest. Is it leave gaiety all to the laity? Cannot the clergy be Irishmen too? Here's a health to you, Father O'Flynn, schlaunty and schlaunty and schlaunty again, powerfulest preacher and tenderest creature and kindliest creature in all Donegal. Well, that was a caution. Now, let's to get to those stories. First off is Mark Wormke with a short little tale about what happens when some British tourists encounter the disarming little priest.
My humble respects to you, Mr. Michael Malarkey, and may I presume to inquire why you have such a grandiose air upon you this fine morning? That's easily answered, Mr. Jeremiah O'Shea. There's been a carriage full of quality down the road with whom I've been conversing and from whom I've been taking my tone, and maybe I haven't been quite able to adjust myself to my present company all to once. Oh, and will your honour's honour condescend to impart to your most obedient servant some small portion of the experiences you have just extracted from them seductive strangers? I will that, Jeremy, you old commercial copybook headliner, you. The quality I met were a big English stockbroker and his wife. Gora, great eatin' they must do over there to get such sizable couples as that together. Their hands never went empty to their mouths at dinner time. Then there were two as fine young ladies as you'd set your eyes on in a summer's day, and full of the fun and frolic, too, and a rather severe-looking young curate. That was the whole of them. They were going very slowly up the hill, the old ones in the carriage and the young ones walking beside it. 'Twas powerful hot when they came in sight of the bridge, when the old gentleman asks me its name. "Sneem Bridge, Your Honor," says I. Convenient to the bridge, four men were working at the wall. Leastways, one was working and the other three were smoking their doudines. The stockbroker winks at his wife and calls out, "One man working and three fools looking on." "Four fools looking on," says Andy Kelly, one of the workmen, in a flash, taking a pipe from his mouth. Mrs. Stockbroker laughed out at this. "Oh, you got it that time, Tom," she said. With that, Father O'Flynn crossed over the road and took off his hat to the ladies, and calling attention to something that had gone wrong with the harness, offered them a cup of tea in his garden while it would be rectified. The young ladies were delighted, and even the sour-faced curate seemed complimented. Well, the father sent me on with them, while he slipped round the corner with some neat excuse or other to buy a pound of the best Lipton and some saffron buns. Then the curate says to me, ingratiating like, "My good man, I suppose you are a Catholic."
"No, your reverence."
"A member of the Church of Ireland."
"Nor that either, your reverence."
Well, he seemed bothered, but he put me through a catalogue of all the Christian persuasions, and heathen ones too, for all I knew about some he mentioned, such as Moravians and Swedenborgians and New Methodist Free Church Presbyterians, till I finally thought I must confess to one of these just to keep him quiet. At last, fairly provoked at not being able to find out what I was, says he to me, with the nearest approach to blasphemy that he could permit himself, "Then in heaven's name, my good fellow, what are you?" I didn't answer him at once, but I looked him all over, his close-shaved puss and his gould cross, and his sacerdotal coat and waistcoat and collar, and says I very slowly and solemnly, "I make bold to think, your reverence, that I belong to the same persuasion as yourself, for I'm a rail good Puseyite." At which the two young ladies had like to die laughing, while his reverence remarked very stiffly, "Really, ladies, I don't think an honest confession of faith like that is any laughing matter." At which I nodded to him to pretend I was as horrified as himself, and winked at one of the young ladies to let on I was funnin' him in earnest. At which she went off again, and then the father comes up with a pound of tea, bumpin' agin him in his tail pocket, and starts conversin' the old lady. Well, as he passed the priest's pool on the river, sure enough, a set of young spalpeens were bathin' in it, for as I said before, it was thunderin' hot. Then nothing would please Mrs. Stockbroker but to remonstrate at their innocent childish ways. "It's quite barbarous," says she.
"What's barbarous, Mum?" says the father.
"Those boys bathing there in the full sight of the high road."
"Where, Mum?" says he.
"There, sir," says she, pointing backhanded like with her parasol at the children.
"Oh, is it there at the other side of the river, Mum?"
And he put up his glass and gave a look across.
"Well, for my part, I'm not in the habit of reading small print at that distance."
"Well, you've caught it now, Julia," says the stockbroker. "That was every bit as good as one I got from that fellow at the roadside." And with that, he turns to the priest and told that laugh against himself that the father hadn't heard before. "But make no mistake," said Father O'Flynn. "No man has a better eye for business than a poor carryman when he gets the chance, even in his own country, which is none too often." And with that, he ups with a story of his own. "A man, convenient to the very place where we are walking, died, and left his farm divided between three sons. It was a grazing farm, and when the funeral was over and Kenmare September Fair came on, I met with the youngest of the three in the middle of it, down on his hands and knees inspecting a heifer's mouth for the world as if he had been a cow dentist itself. 'In the name of all that's decent, Dennis Buckley, what are you doing?' says I.
"Just what I ought to be doing, your reverence," says he. Haven't I been left one-third of the graging on my father's farm? And haven't I been all through the fair to find the heifer with the biggest mouth to represent me best upon it? And Begorra, I do believe I've found her at last. And with that, they went in at the priest's garden gate to their tay.
Next, we have Leslie Best with a Father O'Flynn story about doing a good turn for one of his local Protestant competitors, but a good friend.
Do you remember Parson Flanagan, Mick? Only middling well, Jeremy. I wasn't long come into these parts when they made an Irish professor of him at Trinity College. Yes, we were lost after him, for oh, 'twas he could make the pipes sing to the coolin', or screech laughing with the hare in the corn, or set every foot tapping the floor with the impatience to be out on it, nicking off each note of Paddy Rafferty or Jackson's Morning Brush as they came jigging off of his chanter. Weren't he and Father O'Flynn great together for parson and priest? Deed, and they were forever together, all through the love of the good old Irish music and the good old Irish tongue. Many's the time I've known the parson come to the priest's house with God bless all within, and the father to reply, 100 welcomes to you, parson, and how do you get your health? In Irish, of course. And then they'd settle down to some abstruse argument, how this tune should end off or another begin. The father at it on his fiddle, and the parson on his pipes, till you wouldn't know if you were on your heels or your head between them. But what was that, Jeremy? I heard tell of the good turn the father did the parson, when the Protestant bishop come down to see how he was holding up his parish after the famine times. That wouldn't take long in telling, and I'm the one to tell it, for I was through it from beginning to end. The parson's bishop had got a notion that Flanagan wasn't as successful at the superin' and proselytizing as his predecessor had been, with soup in the one hand and salvation in the other for the poor starving souls where they'd held their Irish mission, when some of our own priests had been a trifle forgetful of their duties. So he wrote to the parson to say he was coming down on such and such a day. Well, with that the parson calls round. "The pleasure of God on you, Father Michael," says he, "and may you live and be happy 12 months and 7 times better than you are this day." "The same to you, parson, but what's the worst news with you? For you seem dejected-like." "And why wouldn't I, Father? For his lordship, Dr. O'Sullivan, is coming down to inspect my mission congregation that's been growing so beautifully less ever since you replaced Father O'Connor. I'll have to go double quick to make room for some young firebrand that'll set our folks by the ears again. So it's goodbye I'll be saying to you, Father Michael, before long. And long sorry I'll be to do it, for the sake of the pleasant companionship we've had together for the old Irish books and the old Irish music." Father O'Flynn seemed quite struck down, and he stood ruminating like in his old shoot of everlasting, with the hands deep down in his breeches pockets. Then suddenly he gave a smile that cracked across his rosy old face like the white streak you'd cut out of a Kerry pippin, and says he, "It's a congregation you want to meet the bishop when you preach before him. Isn't that it, Parson Jack?" "'Tis just that," said the parson, "and where am I to raise one?" "Ask me no question, and I'll tell you no lies," says the father, and grips him hard by the hand, and tells him to be off, and make all his preparations for the bishop with a stout heart. And so he did, and the Protestant bishop drove in his carriage and pair to the church door. He might well rub his eyes at the congregation that he saw sated for an instant. Not the poor 20 or 30, by all accounts, he expected to find, and that would have been found there on any ornery Sunday in the year, but a church full and overflowing. And myself was in it, I can tell you, Mick, though in a back seat. And the parson preached a grand Irish sermon, entirely on the text, "Let brotherly love continue." And all the veins of our hearts, Catholics though the better part of us was, went out to him, I can tell you. Divil a word of it all the bishop understood, though he pretended to, nodding his head at all the unimportant bits, though there weren't many of them. Well, I heard the end of it out of the parson's boy, who was listening at the study door as the bishop was bidden goodbye after the luncheon. "To tell you the truth," said he, "Mr. Flanagan, I was agreeably surprised at the size of your congregation this morning. Indeed, it exceeded my most sanguinary expectoration. I had heard that you were perhaps a little too thick with the Roman Catholics. But it appears you've been so to good purpose, for it has thickened and not thinned your congregation. My only criticism is that some members of it are not quite as familiar with our ritual as they will no doubt be a little later. I mean, in the matter of standing up and kneeling down at the right time. But you are doing a great work, Mr. Flanagan, a great work. And I think that after all, your plan of getting at these poor people in their own language is the true and only one. Be damned, but that bait all, Jeremy. And what did Father O'Flynn say when it was over and done? Well, he heard tell, of course, what a grand sermon the parson had been after preaching to his mixed congregation, and says he to him the next time they met, "Parson Jack, I'm proud to hear you had such a grand congregation the other day to meet your bishop, though I'm very much afraid some of my flock must have strayed into your fold by some misconception or other to augment it. Still, I'm glad when they did find themselves there, they didn't do you or his lordship the disrespect of walking out again at once. Indeed, it has reached me that you preached a very considerate sermon. But, parson, they say you were that persuasive. I'll not venture to loan you another congregation."
Next up, we have Jeff Bowman with a favorite story near and dear to every Irishman's heart, a tale about teetotalers and not-so-earnest teetotalers.
"Put that flute off of your lips, Jeremy. What for, malarkey? You took the pledge, and whistling is the dickens' dry work. Well, I'm thinking that the pipe you favour is drier, but I'm only a semi-teetotal after all. Now there's a tale of casuistry about this semi-teetotality. Well, much more in your total abstinators, according to Father O'Flynn. Well, prove me that. Well, I was waiting for his reverence to come down to settle a disputation that's been going on for a fortnight between meself and my mother-in-law, and I heard him discoursing with his new curate through his study door. 'You're an out-and-out crusader, Father Conn,' says Father O'Flynn. 'Well, I am that, Father,' the curate answered him. 'Are you a territorial crusader?' 'Well, and what might that be?' 'Well, I'll illustrate it this way, Father Conn. When I was in Manchester a few years back, I dined at St. Chad's, and there I met one Father Brophy, a crusader. He was a fine, fresh-looking man, and certainly seemed as if total abstinence agreed with him. But I met him a week later at St. Patrick's in Oldham, and he took his tumbler of punch just like any man. He saw me looking at him, and says he, 'You look horrified at me, Father O'Flynn. So I better explain that I'm a territorial crusader.' 'And what's that?' I asked. 'Well, I abstain with one set of friends, for the sake of example, in Manchester, and I drink with another set, here.' 'And you can keep the pledge in Manchester?' 'Of course I can.' 'Well, I met that curate at Manchester 2 years after, or to be more correct, I met him as priest of a parish. He took his tumbler, mind you, this time. 'So you cease to be a territorial crusader, Father Brophy,' says I. 'I thought you couldn't keep to it.' 'But I have,' says he. 'Only my territory is somewhat more restricted.' 'Well, how's that?' says I. 'Well, it's limited to the parlour where I see my parishioners, and of course to my church and schools. So I'm still a territorial crusader.' 'Ah, then England has a terrible contrary effect upon the Irish clergy, Jeremy, if that tale is true.' 'Well, I'm not sure, Mick, whether casuistry has an equally contrary effect on some of the clergy in this country. For listen to how Father O'Flynn led the new curate on, and the fool he made of him in the end, for he do still be making hares of us all.' 'Do you approve of the action of that Father Brophy?' asked Father O'Flynn of the curate. 'By no manner of means, if he wasn't under doctor's orders.' 'Oh, then the doctor might order you a tumbler of punch every hour in the day, and you might still remain a total abstainer.' 'Well, certainly,' said the curate, 'on the understanding you took it as physic. But for my part, I've never had occasion to call in the doctor in that way, and I hope I never will.' 'Well, I echo that pious sentiment,' says the Father O'Flynn, laughing. though I did notice when you were dining at the castle last night that you made several medical calls on his lordship's French cook. What can you mean, Father Michael? Oh, you understand me well enough, but as you ask for an explanation, I'll give it ye, and attempt to prove that yourself is only a territorial crusader, seeing that baronial halls are outside the jurisdiction of your total abstinence. Well, if you prove it to me, I'll be surprised. Well, then here goes, said Father O'Flynn. How many helpings of clear soup did you take? Well, two, but what's that to say to it? Well, I say nothing again the want of etiquette in asking for a second helping of soup at a dinner party. Beyond this, that as each bowl of soup contained at least half a glass of sherry wine, you took twice as much of that liquor as I did. But how was I to know that there was sherry in the soup? By the sense of taste. You weren't a total abstainer 3 years ago, and many's the pint of sherry you took before that. But I haven't done with you, continues Father O'Flynn. Did you or did you not take two helpings of thrifle and a fine plateful of brandy cherries? Well, I don't deny it, says the curate, but I ate them. Well, what's the moral difference, if you please, between eating alcohol and drinking it? At that, someone came in and shut the door. And I was thankful for it, for I got such a pain in my stomach, Mick, from holding in the laughter that I think I should have died of it if I hadn't been able to let it go then. When Father O'Flynn came out to me, he suspected I'd overheard him. For, says he, something's been amusing you, Mick, and I hope 'twill put you in a more peaceable frame to be reconciled to your mother-in-law. And so it did. And on the way down to the cottage, he remarked, you may tell the neighbours that I've got it in my mind to preach to them a sermon on an early day on the difference between moderate and immoderate temperance. And did you hear the father's sermon, Jeremy? Deed I did, Mick, but however did you miss it? Though having to carry one of the master's cows to the vet. She got into a clover field, and she was that inflated I thought she'd have exploded on the way. You couldn't have blown her out better yourself with the latest aerostatic pump. But the vet's the newfangledest operator entirely. He made a innate indecision in the poor beast with the further end of an old spur. He was a trooper in his time. That's the way to prick the hydropsy out of her, says he. And by the time I got her safe back to the field, yees were all coming out of chapel. But tell us what you can remember the father's discourse. That'd take me too long, Mick, but I'll give ye as much of the consecrated essence of it as I can. Of course, it was full of strong, holy bits that a man like myself wouldn't dare to attempt to travesty to you. And bad enough, dear knows, but I'm not quite as blasphemous as that. Howsomdever, these are some of the lines he steered upon, and troth he seemed to me to do a daily staring to keep the two temperance parties pulling the cause straight between 'em. He began by praising the Crusaders. He said they done a grand work long ago under Father Matthew and took the shine out of all the folk in the two baronies for their quiet conduct and steady industry. But after a bit, they grew to think teetotalism was the one and only mother of virtue, and drink was the sole and single parent of the seven deadly sins. One of them boys, says the father, long before I was priest here, I won't disrespect his memory by mentioning his name, learning that I was in the habit of breaking bread with a respectable publican, Carhervsavan way, not to say taking a glass of punch with him after it, said he couldn't see his way to coming to Mass until I took the pledge along with me two curates. He's dead and gone, poor fella, and he came back to religion in a queer way. He'd been an awful boy at the drink in his own time, but when he turned his back on it, there was no one so hard on any neighbour who took a drop once in a way. And he drove two of his sons out of doors because he caught the smell of whiskey off of them. Well, he got wind one night that a consignment of porter was coming to the Carhervsavan Hotel, so he and some of his out-and-outers disguised themselves as Rorys of the Hill, and makes believe they wanted to rob the porter, and freckin' the driver so they're away with him like mad into the darkness. Then they tapped the barrels and turned their contents into the ditch and off with themselves, as proud as paycocks of their disinterested temperance work. But lo and behold you, in the morning there was a magistrate's warning out against the total abstinator and his friends. And what do you think for? The price of the porter? That in reason, for the carrier had penetrated their disguise. Far worse nor that, the price of half the pigs in them parts that had met their deaths like the Duke of Clarence by suiciding themselves to death in that ditch full of Guinness's porter. You may say that Councillor Connolly had the fine fun out of the case in court. Not content, my lord, says he to the judge, with feloniously abstracting the goods of this respectable hotel keeper, this heartless hypocrite does not share him as Brennan of the Moor would have done with his wild confederates. No, he stoops to villainy of a far deeper dye, I may say the very blackest dye. He places the irresistible temptation of Guinness's best XX in the way of these poor, deluded, dumb creatures whose swollen corpses we have just sorrowfully viewed, but on which he has no doubt feasted his own murderous eyes with malignant satisfaction. Who traited the pigs was the saying they all had out again, me boy, after that. 'Twas a smart piece of experience, but it knocked sense back into the poor fella, and he forgave his sons, and he dropped his vile, intemperate carryings on after that for good and all, though he lived and died a total. I wish the new curate would take example by him then. You heard of what happened between him and poor Halsey? I did not, Mick. Well, Halsey had the heavy drop taken, and was corkscrewing his way to the pub in the best beeline he could construct for himself under the circumstances, when Father Conn grips him by the arm. The devil's following you into that public house, Tom Halsey, says he. Well, if he does, says Tom on the instant, I can't stand him a treat, for I've only the price of the one half glass left me. Yes, Father Conn should be more judgmatical in his dealings with the drink question, but I must hurry off to give my old cow the vet's second bolus. Don't forget to tell me the end of the father's sermon when you're round again in the morning. And he did the next morning when the two old friends met once again. Morrow, Mick, how's the invalid? Finely, thank ye, Jeremy, finely. Eating everything before her and milking away like mad. But you promised me the rest of the father's sermon where I'd be round again. So I did. But where did I get to? Where he was talking at the totals. Ah, to be sure. Well, of course, the moderates and the others were sort smiling to themselves at the warning he was giving them, when, says he, it's my honest conviction that moderation is the true ideal in drinking as well as everything else. Wine and porter and spirits, for the matter of that, are the gift of God if we don't indulge in them beyond reason. At which all the moderates nodded at each other with an air of satisfaction. But what is a moderate after all? There's one I know who passes for one, whom I once overheard giving this prescription for the composition of a glass of punch. Mix the materials in equal portions, half whiskey and the other half whiskey and water. And I heard the same fella advise a friend, whom the doctor had limited to a single glass, to pour the liquor on the outside of it if you want to have more than a thimbleful. Says Father O'Flynn, I'd rather have to deal with the uncharitablest out-and-outer than an insinuating tomfool like that. The totals had the laugh turned to their side now. Indeed, and it's the jokers who do far too much of the devil's work in this poor distressed country of ours, outside the law courts and in them, as if a joke couldn't be cracked without cracking a bottle, not to say a head along with it. I told you it's a tale of a total. Well, I'll tell ye another of a moderate, and leave ye to judge which of the two was the more respectable member of society. He was a real playboy, full of fun and diversion of every sort and kind, and his hotel bar was crowded every day and all day, for he was a publican. Many's the poor boy he was the ruination of by means of his funny tongue, for it became the fashion to go and hear him reel his yarns at the Joker's Rest, as he christened his public. Well, He was full and running over with queer stories from every quarter, and you had only to start a tale yourself for him to match it with a better. And it became the habit for anyone who came to the bar to stand him a treat before taking a drop himself. What a head he must have had, I observed many of you thinking to yourselves, my friends. And so he had. A cruel, hard head, as I'll explain presently. Whenever a boy asked him, "What do you have?" he always answered, "A glass of my special brown sherry." And it became the custom for the young buckeens to drink a lot of that same and pretend they thought it fine, though 'twas dear and nasty doctored stuff at the best. He kept it in two little glass bottles labelled superfine quality. But it was always noticed that he only turned the tap of one of them for himself. And I won't say there was no suspicion it was because it contained the choicest quality. But everyone was out there, and I'll explain to you why. From year's end to year's end, that little glass barrel of his was supplied by his own hand with plain unadulterated toast and water, for which he charged his friends sixpence a glass, for treating him to the best of brown sherry. They say he built a new wing to the Joker's Rest out of what he had saved in 10 years on that same toast and water. And he was a moderate drinker, or rather a territorial crusader, this with a side look at Father Conn, as I've heard some denominate it. Well, he was the terrible rogue entirely, Jeremy. I heard of another one up in Dublin, an old window cleaner by the name of Frank Splay. A friend of mine, one Edward Edge, who was the Protestant Dean of St. Patrick's body servant, used to be telling me about him. Here's one of his notable villainies. "Well, Frank," says Edge to him, says he one day, "how did you fare yesterday?" Well, this Edge had the devil's own queer accent, which I'll try me best to personate for ye. "Well, I was cleaning the windows for such and such an old one," says Splay. "Tell me, did you give you a thundering fine dinner?" "Faith, you did. I ate maybe the best of a leg of mutton. The dinner was out of the way good." "And did she give you ne'er a happerworth to drink?" "Begob, she did so. Heathen," she says, "me poor man, I believe your dinner isn't complete without the drink." "Begor, I believe not, ma'am," says he. Well, what the devil should he do but he takes and drinks 2 or 3 pints of Guinness's finest. "You old tea, Frank," says I, "but you're after breaking Lord Plunkett's pledge." "Heath, I'm not," says he. "Sure, I didn't pay for the porter." Well, there was another time he was cleaning for an old lady on the circular road. Mind you, there was an old cupboard in the corner with the devil a less nor matter of 3 pounds of beef in it. Well, when the old one had her back turned and she's out of the room, what the blazes devilment should he be up to? But he goes up to the cupboard and cruel end to the threepence, but he eat every damn bit of that beef out of that. And bad luck to all, but he sticks the old cat, locks him up in the cupboard. Presently she comes down to the kitchen and opens the press. "Oh, Amelia Murther," says she, "the cat's after eating all of my beef on me, the whole of what I had for your dinner. I'm sorry, me poor man, I've nothing further to give you to eat." "Well, faith, so am I, ma'am," says he, "more's the pity." And he, with the 3 pounds of beef in his old body all the time, the great old thief. He was that, Mick. But be damn it, what a sacrilegious way of talking them two Dublinites had between them.
Another favorite topic of Graves' Father O'Flynn's stories were anecdotes involving medicine, involving both serious doctoring as well as whimsical faith healers. All were fair game for the priest. Here's Lynn Stewart with Father O'Flynn's medical disquisition, first introduced by another whimsical lyric written by Alfred Percival Graves.
"You may tramp the world over, from Delhi to Dover, and sail the salt sea from Archangel to Aragon, circumvent back through the whole zodiac, but to old Dr. Mac you can't furnish a paragon. Have you the dropsy, the gout, the autopsy? Fresh livers and limbs instantaneous he'll shape yes. Know how inferior in skill, but superior, health and lineal posterior to old Aesculapius. He in the wig with the curls so carroty, eagle eye and complexion clarity. Here's to his health, his honour and wealth, the king of his kind and the cream of all charity. Well, what's that screed you're singing, Mick? When the father was given Father Conn after breakfast this morning. And what did the curate think of it? Well, he said 'twas a pity that there wasn't more sense in the songs the people do be singing. Which means the people and the priests, says the father, laughing. But what particular fault do you find with the phraseology of this song, Father Conn? Ah, the geographical description is outrageous. The medical terms employed are inaccurate and revolting, if not indecent. Ah, what a sour face that curate is, Mick. He is so, Jeremy. But before continuing their conversation, give us a bit more of the song. Well, I'll resume it to as far as the father got, to the best of my recollection. How the rich and the poor to consult for a cure crowd onto his door in their carts and their carriages, showing their tongues and unlacing their lungs, for divil one symptom the doctor disparages. Truth now, when he'll tumble, for high or for humble, from his warm feather bed with no cross contrariety, making his light of nursing all night, the beggar in rags as the bell of society. And as if by a miracle, ailments hysterical, dead with one dose of bread pills he can smother, and cure the love sickness with comical quickness, prescribing the right girls and boys to each other. And the suffering children, your eyes 'twould bewilder to see the wee creatures his coattails unravelling, each of them fast on some treasure at last, for old Dr. Max just a toy shop out travelling. He in the wig with the curls so carroty, eagle eye and complexion clarity. Here's to his health, to his honour and wealth, the king of his kind and the cream of all charity. And didn't any of that reach the curate? Well, if it did, he didn't pretend to it, Jeremy. They were eating a pair of turkey's eggs at the time, and says Father O'Flynn, the song I've been singing, together with this egg, reminds me of a medical question I heard was put to a Protestant Dane who was one of my best friends in these parts. He used to live at Park Nasilla before it was converted into a hotel. Well, one day he was driving along by way of Cahir Daniel when he came up with old Father John walking tired-like along the road. "May I offer you a lift, Father O'Sullivan?" said he. "Well, thank you kindly," said the old priest, and got up on the sidecar and away with them for Derry Dean. "I've heard tell," said Father John, "that you are learned in all the sciences, as having been once professor of mathematics at Trinity College. And so it occurs to me you may be able to settle a little matter of special interest to me and my parishioners who rear fine flocks of turkeys and would be glad to establish a medical industry in them. Can you tell me, Mr. Dean, what part of the turkey rhubarb comes from?" Well, even Father Conn laughed at that. "Well, and what part of it does the rhubarb come from, Mick?" "No part of it, you gazebo, but from the country of Turkey." And with that, the two old friends had to go their separate way until the next time they met and resumed their conversation. "We got interrupted in our medical disquisition yesterday, Jeremy, just as I was going to say that the best of medicaments do be coming from furrin parts." "Oh, yes, and the best of the doctors, Mick." "Well, that's true, Jeremy, and I can make you a revelation on that subject that come to me in a letter from Ned Edge only this morning. Let's see, I had it in my pocket. Oh, yes, here it is. Listen to this. Bray, Wednesday, April 30th. "My dear Mick, I told you in my last that Tarpa had pitched his travelling caravan here with us in Dublin, and now I'm writing to give you a full and fair description of him and his open-air demonstration of the healing art. Well, of all the sights, Blood and Anza was the grandest. There was float loads of lads and old women coming to be cured, and there'd be a crowd round Tarpa's yoke as thick as flies, and Tarpa'd be standing on the platform, and whatsoever fancy disguise the Injuns had, him and all the men he had with him helping was in it. Gor, you'd think there was folly in some kind of wild beast caravan. And whatsoever language they spake among the wild savages of Africa, he'd be giving orders to them in it. Then he'd begin, and he'd give the people a parable that'd leave them dumb. He'd tell them there's no mortal disorder, but he could cope with it. Let them only come up on the platform, and he'd soon show them. And then there'd be the divil shouldering and pushing to get up first, and you'd see a man put up, and he may be on sticks with a bad leg, or maybe with cold, watery pains in the arm. Well, Tark would take him, and the two of them would go under some kind of big old wild beast skin, and the band of music would be puffing away all they knew, and Tark would commence rubbing the place, and he'd rub for half an hour with the band going all the time, and the sweat streaming off him with the violence of the rubbing, and at the end of the time he'd say, "You may go down now, you're cured." Oh, and sure, I seen lots of them, and they cured. There was one man I know by the name of Murphy, and he'd been 13 year on crutches with a place in his leg you could put a straw through and pull it out the other end. Well, Murphy's friends advised him for to try tarpa, and when they come up near the carriage, there was a crowd so thick there was damned hard set to get through. But Murphy's gang was the heaviest, and they fought their way up to the platform, and tarpa, he falls to work. Well, whatsomever he did under the old bearskin, bad luck. But he burdened the disorder out of him, and in 10 minutes out they come, and Tarpa told him to go. And Murphy's asked for the old crutches. "Ethan, you want them sticks no more, so be off away with you out of this," said Tarpa. And he throws old sticks away behind his yoke and fired Murphy down off of the platform. And the minute ever he put his feet to the ground, he was off away down the street, and he leapin' with a lot of people after him, running for to keep up with him. God, they run like an open rebellion. So what do you say to that, McMullarky? From your affectionate friend, Edward Edge. Well, Mick, that bangs Banagher. Indeed it do, Jeremy. And that reminds me, I wish Tarpa was here, for maybe he could mend poor old Matt the Piper, for I'm in dread he's not long for this world, from what the neighbours are after telling me. Oh, that's true for you, Mick, for I'm at Father O'Flynn at the crossroads, just as it was sneezing up to 1 o'clock, says he. You ought to go up, Jeremy, to old Matt the Piper and give him a bit of a heart up, for I don't think he'll be much longer with us. Leave him to me, your reverence, says I. Leave him to me. I'll console him so that he'll be glad to be shut of the whole of us. Oh, don't be too hard on him, says his reverence. There was no better piper in Ireland than Matt. Oh, boys, how he tickled the heels. And up went the dear old man's umbrella, and he was just making a cover of the buckle with his off toe when he sees the new quad that they're coming down the road. As I was remarking, Jeremiah, says he, we must console the ages and endeavour to lighten their few remaining days among us. Ah, Father Mulroy, enjoying the cool of the evening. And away with him, talking most learnedly of prognostications and such like disquisitions. So up I goes to old Matt, where he was lying in his daughter's house, her that married John the stepper, and says I, "Well, Matt, me poor man, I hear you're not long for this world." "Aye," says Matt. And his voice was very low and whispery, like the wind among the reeds. "I'll be going soon, and, oh, Jeremy, I'm loath to go." "Loath to go," says I. "Sure, isn't it time you were gone? Haven't you had the best of times here? Was there ever wake or wedding without you? And now, isn't it about time young Matt was stepping into your shoes and maybe handling the bit of money that you have laid by?" "Oh, I know," says he. "I know, and I don't drudge the boy a penny of it at all. Still, I'm loath to go." "Do you think we won't send you off in style?" says I. "Is it that that's troubling you? Faith, if you don't have the bad manners to die in Lent, we'll make it the biggest jollification you ever saw." "Still," says he. "Still," says I, giving him a dig with me fist. "Still, you want to be dawdling on here in everyone's way, beholden to your daughter for the back end of her kitchen? Sure, maybe," says I. "Where you're going, you'll have a house and all your own." "Well, Father Conn was telling me 'twas a fine place and everything of the best, but I'm told 'tis harps and trumpets they play up there, and me fingers are too stiff for the harp, and where would I get the wind for the trumpet?" "Whisht," says I, for I seen the mind was failing on him. "Whisht, you devil. I'll put the pipes in the coffin, would you, and then you'll be as welcome there as you often were here." "And so I will, Mick, so I will, but, oh, man, what will St. Peter say when he sees old Matt marching up to the gate playing Planxty Kelly or the Ace and Deuce of Piperin'?" "What'll he say, Matt? Nothing at all. But fall into step with your chanter. when he's found you an easy chair in the corner of the floor of heaven.
Father O'Flynn was a man of wide-ranging intellectual pursuits. Still, he was also a man of the people, interested in the down-to-earth problems and the ordinary goings-on within his parish. Here's Rob Filipkowski with a story about some not-so-ordinary things that used to be talked about in Father O'Flynn's parish.
What's that you're reading, Mick? Maybe 'tis the newspaper, Jeremy. And if you wish me to be more particular, I might mention it 'tis the Cahersaveen Cornet, which me mother's own sister's son sends me regular. At least when it comes out, which is only occasionally. And what is there new in this one? Nothing particular, only a funny tale or two of Kane O'Connor, a noted playboy beyond Benoît. Reads a taste of it, Mick. It is stated on good authority that O'Connor once acted as water bailiff for Mr. Christopher Bland of Derry Quincastle, County Kerry. He had occupied a miserable holding on the mountainside, barely managing to keep body and soul together by the produce of his potato patch and oatfield, supplemented by an occasional poached hare or salmon. But Mr. Bland mercifully made him his water bailiff, an office which O'Connor discharged with the most exemplary... Come to the story, Mick, and skip all that fine writing. Here's the spice and kernel of it. The river was in flood, and your man, Mr. Bland, was on the wrong side of it for the fishing. "Will you carry me over, Kane?" said he. "I will, and welcome, Your Honour," says Kane, stripping off his drawers, for that was all he wore worth mentioning in the summertime, saving our fair readers' presences. Well, when he got into the centre of the stream, with his landlord on his back, says he, "Master, the knees are going under me, and I don't think I'll have the strength to get across with you, unless you forgive me that quarter's rent." That was damn good, Mick, and I believe it was true, for I heard the Dane telling it to his two sons one day. I was carrying their baskets for them, and they fishing up the Ulry, and do you know what name they had put it on? Kane O'Connor? What was that, Jeremy? The Bull, no less, for I heard them saying, "There's the Bull coming." "Where?" says I, getting hold of the gaff to be prepared like if the bass should look controversial, at which they burst with laughing, and when O'Connor, for it was him they were alluding to, went past them quieter than I ever known him, I coaxed it out of one of the young gentlemen why they had fixed that sobriquet upon the old rogue. Well, it appears they'd been out fishing trout, as they were that day, around and about Drumteen, and after eating their luncheon, sandwiches and bread and cheese and half a dandy porther apiece, and giving O'Connor a bite and sup for himself, the trout were rising so free that they concluded for to keep the rest of their rations for the evening, and O'Connor had the carrying of them. But when their tea-time came, O'Connor pulls a very long face when he takes the basket off his back and starts taking out the provisions. "'Tis as I suspected," says he. "What's as you suspected?" says the Dane. "That the Bulls eat everything out of the basket before him, and drank everything too, bad manners to the unconscionable beast. You see, Your Honour's Reverence, I was getting some worms for Master Jack there, and I foolishly left the basket down on the bank, when the Bull comes ravaging by, and as we're not the best of friends, I made off out of that in three skips of a lame flea, and me boyo, it seems, wasn't quite as mad as he made believe." "Tell all that to the horse marines," said Master Jack. "You robbed the basket yourself." "I robbed the basket, Master Jack, and lower meself in the Dane's opinion and yours to the level of that brute beast of the field who took the main advantage of you. I'm heart scalded at the thought." And the rogue of the world downfaced them that the Bull had done it all the time. So they put the name of the Bull upon him, and it's held tight to Kane O'Connor ever since. Poor Kane, 'twas starvation got the better of him. The small bite and sup he got, when they had twice as much himself, only provoked his appetite to make him forget himself. And how could he confess it to it afterwards and retain any vestige of respectability? But there's a word here in the comment that I'm not so sure of. 'Tis the heading of a paragraph. Burglary. After a fruitless search, all the money was discovered, with the exception of a pair of Morocco leather boots. What's a burglary, Jeremy? Oh, 'tis the same as robbery, Mick. Robbery? I don't see much robbery in that. But if you'd wish to know what rail right down robbery was, you ought to hear old Ned Edge tell the story of Joe Kelly, the blind piper, and the Bray Robbers. Can't you recollect it yourself, Mick? I'll do me endeavor, Jeremy. There was one time Joe was living above beyant on the Pivy, and the man he was living with was accused for to have a great of money. Well, one night a cruel gang of Bray Robbers come to the house and made their way in at the front door. Old Joe, he hears them, and he slips out of bed, and he takes down his big old blunderbuss, and it as wide as a cannon, and bad luck, but he fills it up to the neck with buckshot, swanderups, and slugs, and says he to the missus, but afeard for her life, "Mrs. Kelly, no need to worry," says Joe, "I'll soon make them quit that anyhow." So he comes to the head of the stairs in his old blind eyes in his nightshirt, and he calls out, "What call have yez to be here at all, at all? I hold yez if yez don't quit this on the minute, I'll fire in amongst yez, so I will." Well, bad luck, there's not a stir out of them. So he roars out to them the second time, "Be me sowkins, if yez won't answer, I'll blaze in amongst yez and be damned to the whole of yez." Well, fire the inch. Did they move after that? Well, after the third offer, what the divil does, me lad, is but he ups with the big old blunderbuss, and it as wide as a cannon, to his shoulder and sweeps the legs from under him. Faith, and he tore the legs and the bodies off of them. Stripped legs, bodies and all. Divil and all off of them. And they made off away down the street, and for the next 6 weeks they was laid up in disguise, with all the time the slugs and swan drops coming out of their legs. So he got shut of them that time anyhow, and they never offered for to come again.
Father O'Flynn never failed to tell a story, no matter how humorous, witty, or droll, that didn't have a moral purpose to its telling. Here's Karen Filipkowski reading one such tale involving poisoned sandwiches.
"What are ye laughing to yourself about, Malarkey? Well, 'tis the recollection of a tale Father O'Flynn was telling the quality here yesterday night up at the castle beyond, and I waiting upon them, Jeremy. 'Tis wisdom ye get when ye wait on the Father, Mick, but tell us the tale over and don't keep the diversion of it all to yourself. Well, then, here's the whole box and dice of it, Jeremy, though of course I don't pretend to put the Father's elegant pronunciation on any anecdote of his. 80 years agone," said his reverence as he gave his greens a dust of the pepper box and began handling his knife and fork over a rail fine slice of saddle mutton. 80 years agone, the Sligo coach was druv by an original by the name of Mick McCluskey. I'll trouble you for your current jilly, your lordship. Well, he was as full of Homer and Virgil as a turkey's egg is full of meat. But all that high learning didn't choke the fun and frolic out of him, but mixed so finely with it that Dan O'Donnell himself got as much as he gave McCluskey when he rode beside him on the box. Yes, I'll take another slice of that Kerry mutton, thank you. I'm always constant to it. Well, this McCluskey was a rare methodical for an Irishman, always on the tick of time, whether changing his horses or watering or feeding them. And he was that particular about his own eating and drinking, you'd think he was regulated by machinery. For instance, he used to bring out 6 ham or beef sandwiches at exactly the same spot on the road all through the coaching season. Well, since you're so pressing, my lady, just one more slice of mutton. Where was I? Oh, at the sandwiches. But one fine day, a pair of young Dublin bloods, who were taking the Sligo coach for the first time, thought they'd play a real clever trick on McCluskey. So they stole and ate his sandwiches, which they'd seen him storing away in the boot when he came out of the inn yard in the morning. Well, at his usual aiding point, McCluskey looks for his sandwiches, and as he was hunting for them high and low, he hears one of the strangers sniggering behind him. Me boy takes no notice of this, but presently, when a couple of wicked dogs came racing into the road, barking and snapping at his team like mad, says he with a disconsolate groan, "Be damned, but 'tis the big fool I am. I thought I was provided for them two canine villains there, but I finally left the provender after me that I'd intended for them." "And what was that, McCluskey?" asks one of the travellers. "Well, you see, I'd made up my mind to exterminate them cannibals, and I'd put together as neat an assortment of pies and sandwiches as you could wish to see. But the homadonna of the world that I was, I must have left them after me at the inn. Though I could almost be sworn I put them in the boot." By this time, them two young bloods were whispering together and getting as green in the gills as if the sandwiches had been arsenated in earnest. They confessed to the antics they'd been after and abjured McCluskey to gallop them to the next town or they'd be dead men and make no mistake. "My poor young gentleman," says McCluskey, "I'm afraid you must be saying your prayers. Dr. McCarthy's away on his holiday and the young medical student who's doing duty for him isn't experienced enough to administer the stomach pump." "Then in heaven's name, what are we to do?" they asked. "Well, I'll tell you what you'll do, and it's your last and only chance. We'll be dipping by the side of the bay in another 10 minutes. An emetic's what you want. The sea water is the most powerful natural one I know, besides being the divil's own antidote for pison. What you'll do is this. You'll get into your vests and stockings, for there's no bathing suits about, and you'll go in and souse yourselves head over heels in that fine Atlantic water. And you'll each of you suck down the measure of a gallon or two of that same. And I promise you that, though you may feel a trifle uneasy inside, you'll stand a good chance of circumventing the pison after all." So down my young bloods got and started stripping themselves like fury, and out with them into the sea like a pair of haunted compasses, puffing and plunging and swallowing down draft after draft of salt water with the greatest of animosity, while McCluskey and the rest of us kept encouraging them to continue the salt water cure, till sorrow a drop more of it could they hold. "You can come out now," says McCluskey, and out they crawled more dead than alive. You may say that was the last practical joke tried on McCluskey. "Thank ye, my lady, I will. I was always partial to butter pudding."
We've saved the best for last. Here's Kathy Chepesky with what should be a sad story about the passing of Ned Edge, who we've already met, but it doesn't quite turn out that way.
"What's the trouble with you, Mick? What for you wearing that black tie? I never heard tell you had lost a relation."
"I lost more than that, Jeremy. I lost a good friend. And a relations, even the nearest, aren't that. But he was that to me. That was Ned Edge."
"Do you say he's gone? That droll boy whose letters you were reading me a while back. And how did you get the black news of it, Mick?"
"In this letter from his young master, Mr. Hercules West, who says he'd be under great obligations to me if I gave him the use of any letters of poor Edge's I had kept, as he was going to write his autobiography for private circulation. You know he was the Dane of St. Patrick's own body servant and lodge porter, and so noted for his sayings, which Mr. West, it seems, has been taken down for the good of his friends and acquaintances, that when they are properly collected, they'll make a new book of proverbs entirely. But how will he print the strong bits of his letters? For the boy had a fine free way of writing his feelings. 'Twasn't many a curse that he used to be dodging. You remember that letter of his you lent me to show Father O'Flynn after reading it to me? The one about tarp and his cures. The father had liked to cry laughing over it, but says he when it was done, 'Pity 'tisn't quite fit for publication, for it bates Carlton and Lever and the lot of them out of the field.' So I looks it over again and found you'd soften it down a deal in the reading. And how will Mr. West print it at all then, just as it came from Ned's pen? But damn, but didn't I tell you that it was for private circulation he was doing it, Jeremy? And isn't he a great scholar, and can't you trust him to put anything into Greek characters that might bring a blush to the cheeks of the printer's divils if he wrote it in English? Anyhow, he's going to do it, and he's promised me a copy of the book when it's out. and then I'll live again with poor Ned. And even now, as I go about my work, his words keep starting up into my mind. For instance, as I saw the waves tossing in from the bay this morning, I remembered what he said to me once below at Brayhead when I was there with Father Healy. Ah, the waves up here does be nothing towards what there was below in Newcastle coming up to 40 or 50 year ago. There'd be waves there and bluganowns. There'd be room for a whole regiment to march in under the curdle, the wave with the arch it'd make. And when we were walking over the same shore, says Ned to me, says he, I mind one day there was a wreck, and maybe 30 big puncheons of rum come ashore, and all the people ran up and knocked in the head of the puncheons with stones, and drank themselves full up to the neck out of old boots and buckets and anything they could lay hold of. Well, of all the divil sights that ever was, I bet the world, the people would be lying about and they drunk and not a stir out of them. And three sergeants going about with stomach pumps, pumping the alcorn out of their bodies. I give me throat, it was the dead mortal of a field of battle. Well, Jeremy, as the postman passed me an hour since, it seemed as if Ned Edge was telling one of his queer tales right into me ear in his very own words. I mind the time, he seemed for to say, when old Daisy had a litter of pups without in the lodge, and one morning when the postman come in on the gate, out she flies at him, and begob you'd faint for to have seen him, and he dropping the letters as he ran up to the steps, roaring with the little bitch fast in the seat of his breeches. Well, of all the divil's murder ever you witnessed, hath, and it was as well it was only his old trousers she got her teeth in, for mind you, if it was a thing blood was through out of the postman, it was £5 out of the master's pocket. Then I declare to you, Jeremy, I was only 2 fields away from you when a gander got up from under my very feet till me heart went into me mouth, and he looked up in me face, and it seemed as if he was reminding me of something. And sure enough, it all came back to me about Ned Edge and the barbaress's gander. Tell us it, Mick, in his own words, as no one has a better call to do. Well, Jeremy, this is how he told the tale to me. One evening, coming up to Christmas, I was in an old barber's above in New Street, getting shaved by a girl from the yellow splash of Arkla. Ah, sure, it's a piece of ground be the say with houses on it, just outside Arkla. Anyhow, I was in there and she was shaving me. All of a sudden, be the good man, something under the chair commenced roaring and squealing. Masha, what the hell blazes have you under the chair, says I to her. Heth, and she says, sure isn't it a gander in a crib I'm keeping for me Christmas dinner? Faith, says I suppose about time you'll be wanting him killed. Heth, and I do, says she. So when she'd done shaving me, what the blaker should I do but I grips the old razor, and in 3 minutes I had me lad out of the crib, and it killed and plucked, and bedammit, the girl from the yellow splash invited me for to come and have a goot off him o' Christmas Day. Sure then, Mick, if the Dane's Son book is all of the one pattern with that, Boswell's Johnson won't be in it with West's Edge.
And so, too quickly, we come to the end of our show today about genial Father O'Flynn. It's worth reminding you all that if you don't know someone who sounds like Mick Mountlarkey or Father O'Flynn, then perhaps it's time to search out a few places in the Upper Ottawa Valley this coming St. Patrick's Day and listen closely to what's being said or sung or played on a fiddle. And we're not talking churches unless the choir suddenly breaks out into that classic Irish jig, Father O'Flynn. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for Leslie Betts, Jeff Bowman, Kathy Chepesky, Karen and Rob Filipkowski, and Mark Wormke, and our producer, Barry Conway, have a great St. Patrick's Day. Good day, and God bless.